He is the founding and senior pastor of Hope Community Church. And to some of you, that name should ring a bell because it's also here in Minneapolis, downtown. They have a few different campuses around the Twin Cities area, though. And Hope was a big part of Antioch being Antioch. And so I'm sure Steve has seen quite a few things in the life of Antioch and Hope and how God has moved in the Twin Cities. And so it's exciting to hear from another pastor from the Twin Cities. Steve actually grew up in Minnesota, and while at the U of M, Jesus Christ changed his life. After being involved in campus ministry as a student and then 5 years as a staff person, he decided to go into pastoral ministry and church planting, and he became the founding pastor of Hope Community Church in 1996. His wife, Carol, and him have 3 children and 2 grandchildren. 3 grandchildren now. So congratulate them on that. At Hope, he spends most of his time teaching, helping new churches get started, mentoring and coaching the 3 lead pastors of Hope's 3 different locations. So we're very blessed to hear from Steve this morning. So I'll have Jeff and then we'll welcome Steve.
Jesus continued, "There was a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we have to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' This is the word of the Lord."
Well, good morning. So, Hope Community Church was the place where Antioch kind of came from. So, that's often in the church world, that's we're known as your mother church. So, that would make me your dad. Would your daddy?
I'm your daddy.
So, we housed many people at Hope in late 2006. Let's see, yeah, there you go. 2006, 2007, we launched in 2008. It's been a privilege to be a part of you all and to see new churches start. We've had the privilege of starting 11 churches in Minnesota. But that is really what kind of floats our boat, because we think that is the way you change things, not by one large church, but by multiple churches having a variety of impact. We're very excited about your kind of reboot in a new space at DeLaSalle High School. I have mixed feelings on that because my kid went to Minnehaha. This was an arch rival, you know, but at the same time, love it. Great space. Glad that you're all here. I am married to Carol, and I do have three boys. This is a picture of the boys when they were young, okay? So now, I have three grandkids now. After the service, we'll be showing 700 pictures on the screen of all my grandchildren. Just kidding. But now they're my grandkids are really young, and this is a picture. I believe my oldest was about seven. That's David in the middle. David in the middle, and then we have Jonathan and Kelvin. And this is the kind of picture. We hired a professional, whole thing, right? Life never looked like that, ever. This is the kind of thing we put on Facebook, because what you're doing on Facebook, sure, we all say, or Instagram, or whatever you people use nowadays, you put it up there and you say, I'm just letting people know about me. No, you're not. You're marketing yourself, right? You're marketing, this is my family. That was never my family except for 1.6 seconds when they were threatened with bodily harm if they didn't stay like that, right? Raising those boys, raising those brothers was more like this. It was more like the movie, that was it's an old movie now, but that was more like what happened. My boys would come home from school and they would instantly fall on the floor and start a wrestling match. The golden retriever would get into it. It was just chaos from the moment. Let's see, 91, so the oldest now is 33, and then 31 and 28. They still do it from time to time. They clear all the furniture, and they have at it right there in the living room. There's something about, I didn't have any daughters to give a little civility to their room, you know what I'm saying? And now I got a granddaughter, so that's, thank you, Jesus. First girl, if you go straight back in my lineage in 108 years. It's like, you just don't do that, I guess. So I've always been intrigued when I look at the relationship of boys, siblings, all that kind of thing, having seen it firsthand. And so when I want to look at a passage of Scripture, I hope there are a few people here this morning that are brand new to the Bible. Like, brand new, you've never heard this parable. My guess is most of you have. Therefore, my job is harder because the familiar sometimes is, yeah. It's like singing happy birthday. We know how it goes, right? And I have to do a little bit extra work to kind of get you back in there and to actually shock you the way the parable actually is shocking. So this morning we're looking at a dad and his kids, a dad and two of his boys. Jesus is going to tell a story. He's making it. It's called, his stories are called parables. And he is making a point on his parables, right? So I'm gonna go on and say that this particular parable that Jesus is saying has four parts to it, four acts, if you want to, or scenes, however you want to do it, okay? So it's four scenes to it. Now, if you're already checked out saying, I can't believe this guy is gonna do the parable of the prodigal son, come on. This is the oldest, I know, just stop, okay? I want you to open your mind up to what this act, and be surprised once again by it. Act one. Act one is, I wish you were dead. Okay? Look what happens in act one. It says that the younger brother, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them, right? That's what's going on here. Now, there's something interesting in this, and we didn't read beforehand. Just for the sake of time, but it says that Jesus continued, right? In verse 11, it says Jesus continued. Well, what was he continuing? Well, you got to go back to the beginning of Luke chapter 15. In Luke chapter 15, you see the context of what's happening here. It is where, if you look at the first four verses, it says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day, the pastors of the day, okay? Take a shot at myself there. sorry. And the teachers of the law muttered, it's a great word, muttering, right? This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Then Jesus told them this parable. Now, let me just stop right there for a second. If you mutter about Jesus, and Jesus is going to tell you a story, you're the bad guy in the story. That's just what's going to happen, okay? That's what's going on here. And he says, suppose one of you has 100 sheep. And he unfolds into what this Luke 15. It starts off with this picture of this has a person that has 100 sheep. He loses one of them. He actually leaves the 99 and goes after the one, finds it, and rejoices, right? Second part of the parable, you can go to that grid if you want. The second part of this whole thing in Luke 15 is this woman who's got 10 coins, but then she loses one, and it drives her nuts. Now, I should acknowledge everybody. Sorry about that. Yeah, but if you are, I just clicked, I just had my 10th birthday, and my keys are a sign of, I think, God saying, here's how I feel about lost things, okay? Because I'm always saying, where are they? So this woman loses this coin, and she can't find it. She sweeps the whole house. She finds it. She throws a party for everybody to come, which means, listen, she spent more than the coin on the party. But it's just the fact that she had lost something she rejoices about, right? Well, now we go to a shift of gears, and we're going to now talk about a lost son. He says, a man has two sons, and you're going to see this, and you can see where the different, go back there just one second. You can see the Pharisees are going to be these other groups, right? The interesting thing about the other two, when we have a sheep and we have a coin, is they're not inanimate, but they can't speak, right? We can't hear what they're thinking. When Jesus expands the concept to include these sons, we now hear what they're thinking. So let's meet them real briefly. First of all, you have the younger son, right? And the younger son is the younger brother. I mean, he's the younger brother. He's the one you just want to whack upside the head, right? That's a metaphor, by the way. I'm just saying, don't really do that. But they're younger brothers. They're kind of annoying, right? So annoying that he actually would come to the dad and say, I want my inheritance. Okay? Now, when he does that, there's a passage here in Deuteronomy that shows that, basically speaking, the younger brother's going to get, the oldest brother's going to get a double portion. Part of the reason for that was to keep the family name and the business going, and everybody else is going to get an equal share. So in this case, there's two sons, two-thirds to the older brother, one-third to the younger brother. So he's not going to get a whole lot, but he wants it now. I have a quote here from a book that I absolutely love. It's a book called The Cross and the Prodigal, Luke 15, Through the Eyes of Middle Eastern Peasants. Okay? And so, there we go. It says this. As Joachim Jeremias has pointed out, there were legal procedures available if the father chose to buy the property. But naturally, these procedures were expected to be used only as death approached. In such a case, an heir was given the legal right of possession, but not the right of disposition. The property was his, but his father still had control over it. This is clearly the situation with the older son. As we see at the end of the parable, his father says to him, all that I have is yours. But at the same time, the father still has authority to slaughter order the slaughter of the calf. In the beginning of the younger son demands and is granted both the right of possession and of disposition. He gets the stuff. We'll see that in just a minute. But this is not the real issue. Granted, the legal procedures were in place if the father chose to use them, but it is, and most certainly was unthinkable for any son to request his portion of the family wealth while his father was still alive. Now, I know you think, why did I quote that? I probably wasted time, maybe, but the whole point is, it's just as offensive today as it would have been then, right? Even maybe more so, just that this is, it's like a shocking thing in the story. You should be shocked at this, as much as if it were to happen today. Look at the father. The father, in this story, he actually goes ahead. Go ahead, one more. The father actually does it. Okay? Now, a lot of ink has been spilled on, like, why would the Father do that? Here's why the Father would do that. Because Jesus wanted him to. Jesus is making up a story. But God doesn't exist, okay? He doesn't. Jesus is a master storyteller. And he's making this story really bizarre. Right? And so it's like, wait, this younger brat asked for something, and the dad gives it to him. Yes, it does. Because Jesus wants it to in the story. And the older brother does nothing. Okay? He doesn't say anything here. He's completely passive, which is what men do best. All right. Now, that's all scene one. Scene two, act two, is how's that working out for you? How now, Brown? Right? Keep moving on the story. Not long after that, the son got together all he had. So he either had an estate sale or something, or was able to transport whatever he had. He moves on from there, and it says he squandered his wealth in wild living. Right? Instant gratification. I see it, I want it, I spend it, I go for it. And he blows it all. So we're assuming that the father, since it's an estate, there's some semblance of wealth here. And this kid goes out and absolutely blows it in a short period of time, right? Then it goes on to say, and after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country. Again, Jesus is making this story up, so he's trying to make it bad, and it is bad. He blew it all. Guess what? There's nothing. And he began to be in need. So he went out and hired himself to a citizen of the country who sent him to his field to feed pigs. Okay, I know we lost Floyd and Rosedale yesterday. Pig, I think the pig thing, the original bet, came from Iowa. Have you ever been to Iowa or driven by a pig farm? Ooh. I mean, like, ooh. Have you ever do that, the drive to Colorado from Nebraska? And I say that because why would anybody stop in Nebraska? I just say, well, through it. You'll drive by a pig farm, and if your windows are down, good luck. It is nasty, right? Okay, so Jesus is painting this picture with a pretty nasty job. But you gotta also remember something, and hear this from Jewish. Pigs were unclean animals. Jews weren't supposed to be anywhere near pigs. So Jesus is saying he got the worst job he could possibly get. And there's a famine, and he blew all his money, right? Jesus is painting this picture for you. And it says he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. He made this measly wage. He could barely even eat. He'd rather eat what the pigs are eating. Okay? Jesus is the master. He's a master painter of this story. Because if we really stop and think about it, it's shocking, right? All these details. Okay, we keep going on. And it says, when he came to his senses, that means he didn't have his senses before, or he had what we would say is nonsense, right? But when he came to his senses, it's very important to see this. What did he come to his senses about? When he came to his senses, he says to himself, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? That's what he came to his senses about. If you look at the prodigal son, that's what he's called. I'll talk about that word in just a minute. You keep using that word. It does not mean what you think it means. This prodigal son, we think of him as nobly coming home. Dude, this was an economic decision. This is not noble. He's just like, I'm hungry. Dad's got food. I'm going home. How many of them have food? I will set out, and he puts together a plan. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So the only thing he asks for, he doesn't ask for forgiveness, he just tells him, this is what I did. But he asks for a job. This is an economic reality. It's not noble. Okay? Let's not make it any better than it is. So he got up and went to his father. Okay? And the boy's coming home. He goes to his father. Now, what's he going to expect? This is where this book that I mentioned by Kenneth Bailey, The Prodigal in the Eyes of Middle Easterners, this is super helpful to hear this. So, it says, First century Jewish custom dictated that if a Jewish boy lost the family inheritance among the Gentiles and dared to return home, the community would, as he's coming home, if he dared to come home, they would break a large pot in front of him and cry out, "His name is cut off from his people." This ceremony was called a kezizah, or literally the cutting off, kezizah ceremony. This is what he was expecting. After it was performed, the community would have nothing to do with the wayward person. By selling his inheritance and taking it with him, the prodigal takes a huge risk. If he loses that money among the Gentiles, he burns his bridges and has no way to return home. He has no more rights to claim, and no one will take him in. This is what, as he says, and they would have known this, as the listeners there, they would have known, when it says he's ready to go home, they're picturing this happening. Okay? Which takes us to Act 3, which I'm going to call The Prodigal God. This is, Tim Keller has written a book on this parable, actually, The Prodigal God. And the word prodigal, we use the word prodigal to talk about, like, a wayward person. But that's actually not the meaning of the word. The word actually means lavish, wasteful expenditure, just this beautiful thing. You recklessly spendthrift, right? Yielding abundant luxury. That's why they call him the prodigal son, originally, because it meant he went out and squandered. He spent all his wealth. That's what made him the prodigal. But the ironic thing about this is we see in this, it's trying to teach us something about who God is, right? You don't have to do too many connecting of the dots here to see after the first two parables what Jesus is doing here. These tax collectors and sinners are sitting there. The Pharisees are muttering them. He's talking about the value of these tax collectors and sinners coming home and being found. And so he's going to do the same here. And this is what it says. It says, "But while," this is probably my favorite verse in the whole, "but while he was still a long way off, the father saw him and was filled with compassion for him." Now just do the math. While he was still a long way off, how in the world would the father in the story know that the son is still a long ways off? Because he's looking for him. He's scanning the horizon for his boy. And he sees this dot in the distance. And he says, "That has the same gait, you know, the way a person walks, as my boy." And it says that he was filled with compassion for him. Then it goes on to say that he ran to him. And I'm going to show you why in just a minute. That actually shows his justice. And you're not going to see that yet until we kind of walk this, but I'm going to come back. Just hang on. This actually shows not only his compassion, but his running to him shows his justice. And then it shows his joy. He ran to him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. I used to show up, I don't do it anymore, but there's a very famous painting. And I can't remember, it's very famous, it might be Michelangelo or someone like that, very famous, of this scene. And it's basically the prodigal on his knees, and the father's got his hand up. This is squeezing the stuffing out of the kid, right? He's squeezing the stuffing out of the kid, hugging him, caring for him, kissing him. Okay? And then the son says, I'll come back. Sorry, let's go. Now, let's talk a little bit about what is going on here at this moment. Remember, let's go back to Kenneth Bailey and kind of unpack it a little bit. It says, as soon as they discovered that the money had been lost among the Gentiles, the kezizah ceremony would have been enacted. The son would then be obliged to sit for some time outside the gate of the family home before being allowed even to see the father. Finally, he would be summoned. With the boy already rejected by the village, the father would be very angry, and the boy would be obliged to apologize for everything as he pleaded for job training in the next village. But that is not what happened. This is just we maybe don't see it as much, but then what it says is a major twist in the story. No one in the village in that time thinks or acts as a separate person, but as a part of a tightly knit village society. The individual's solidarity with that community is unshakable. The father, however, reacts in a very countercultural manner. He breaks all the rules of Oriental patriarchy as he runs down the road to reconcile his son to himself. The word run in Greek, draman, is the technical term used for the foot races in the stadium. Luke, the author of the Gospel of Luke, is a well-educated man. Chooses his words very carefully. Thus we can translate the phrase, his father saw him and had compassion and raced. His father saw him, it is not just a slow shuffle or a fast walk. He races. In the Middle East, a man of his age and position always walks with a slow, dignified fashion. It is safe to assume that he has not run anywhere for any purpose for 40 years. People ask me that, do you run? I would say, from what? Right? But now the father races down the road. To do so, in that culture, remember, he must take the front edge of his robes in his hand like a teenager. When he does this, when he does this, his legs show on what is considered a humiliated posture. I purposely didn't wear shorts. You notice the old man's legs? Just think about that. He pulls them up. All this is a painfully shameful for him. The loiterers in the street will be distracted from tormenting the prodigal and will instead run after the father, amazed at seeing the respected village elder shaming himself publicly. It is his compassion that leads the father to race out to his son. He knows what his son will face in the village. He takes upon himself the shame and humiliation due the prophet. That's what's happening here when he runs out. All this is going to take place by the village, and instead it goes to him. Remind you of anybody? Right? Hebrews tells us that for the joy set before him, Christ endured the cross, scorning its shame. Christ took our shame. Christ saw us as we were adopted in the distance and ran out in an undignified, very lanky, awkward way for us. Keep moving on here. What does the son say? The son says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Now, it's very interesting. You know, there's two versions of this, right? The one that he practices, the practice speech, and then the one, go ahead and put them both up there. The practice speech in here is the other one. The interesting thing in the second one, Luke 15:21, is doesn't ask for a job. It's finally after seeing what the father has done for him that he realizes, oh, the problem really was my relationship with you. After seeing this death, oh my gosh, right? But don't think that his repentance to come to the father was not noble, but at this moment he realizes, no, Dad, it's against you. And it changes everything for who he is. Okay, now, where are we at here? Okay, great. Let's see the father's response. The father's response is utterly shocking. He does not yell at the kid. He does not ask for his heirlooms back. He does not say, hey, that really hurt. Ultra statements. But it says, the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to partake. Okay, they really went at it. I showed you a picture of my boys. My youngest son, when he was about 6, we were out at my uncle's house. He lived in Fertile, Minnesota. Remember that is what's up, Crookston area. western Minnesota, and he was a bachelor farmer, and so he rented his property and worked for other people, did all kinds of different things. But one of the things, because he had a certain amount of land, is he would grow some corn, and then he would build deer stands, and they would basically pick their deer. He had two deer stands. These things were the Taj Mahal. Like, they had a heater in them, and a bathroom, and they're talking, this is like, come on, this is nothing, you know? So he had just built this one, and he had another one that was actually their main one, but they wanted one on the side, too, I guess, for multiple people. And so we were just going to go look at the new deer stand. So we all went out there, and like I said, I have three boys, my wife, I think my parents were along on this trip, but anyway, we went out. And you have to be, you know, you can only go so many people up there at a time. So a few of us went up, and then a few of us came down, and then we went back, and then I went up. I know I went up with my wife, and then Calvin came up, but then he went down. I was like, okay. And then we were up there for a little bit. We got chatting about something, you know, and came down. We walked back to my uncle's place, and when we get there, it's about, I don't know, a quarter mile, half a mile away. As we get there, everybody kind of looks and goes, where's Calvin? He's gone. He went down and didn't take a left at Albuquerque. You know what I'm saying? He went somewhere else. He's gone. My six-year-old is lost in the woods. So we're like, okay, let's make sure he's not out there. Really aren't any busy streets. It was all dirt roads, but get on the back of my uncle's four-wheeler, and we're going around all over the place trying to find him. About half an hour, we're trying to find him. And there is no problem praying during that half hour, right? It is just, I have lost my kid in the woods. This is horrific. So after half an hour, we're like, we might be having to call the police. So we come back, this is before cell phones and all that, so we come back into his place, and he's there. He was able to find his way back. And that sense of something that you value so dearly being found is, I think, God's way of saying, get it now? You get this now? You get where I'm going with this? This boy of mine was lost, and he's home. For everyone in this room who's come to a point where they've trusted Jesus Christ, that is what he feels. He deeply loves it when people come home. Okay? It's clearly where we're going with this parable. But that's not the end of the parable. You think it would be. It's kind of where the other ones end. We get a bonus. We get a bonus one on this one. The bonus act. The encore. We're going to hear about the good stuff. And it says, meanwhile, back at the ranch, right? Meanwhile, the older son was out in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he's coming up near the house, he's walking in, and he sees the lights flicker. See the whole thing? Sorry about that. I didn't warn you. You know, and this whole thing just going nuts, and they're just partying like crazy. You know, cut like my cartoon, yeah. They're just going nuts, right? So he says, you know, calls one of the servants, what's going on? What's happening? He says, your brother has come. Your brother has come. That's what he tells him. Your brother has come. And your father has killed a fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound. What's the older boy's reaction going to be? The older brother became angry and refused to go in. This party's happening. All the villagers who were going to mock and push aside the kid at the entrance there, they're all there and they're partying like crazy because his son is back. And the son won't go in. So his father, it says, went out to plead with the son. Now listen to Kenneth Bailey on this one more time. Last time, Kenneth Bailey. Everyone in the banquet hall tenses expectantly, awaiting the father's reaction. They assume the older son will be punished immediately or ignored until the guests are gone and then dealt with harshly. For the second time in the same day, the father's response is incredible. Once again, he demonstrates a willingness to endure shame and self-emptying love in order to reconcile. The parable briefly and succinctly states, his father came out and entreated him. It is almost impossible to convey the shock that must have reverberated through the banquet hall when the father deliberately left his guests, humiliated himself again before all, and went out in the courtyard to try to reconcile his older son. Look at the son's response. But he answers his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you." Well, that's an interesting way to talk about your dad. "And you and never disobeyed your orders." Disobeyed orders? Was this in the military? Right? Never disobeyed your orders. "Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours," doesn't call him his brother, "but when this son of yours," really dad, you're the fault. This is your fault. You raised this kid. "When this son of yours who squandered your property and prostitutes come home, you killed a fatted calf for him." What this older brother is saying is, "You are unfair. I deserve better than him. I didn't do anything like this. I get nothing." It's a closed fit. It's a demandingness towards the father. Tim Keller, I quoted I told you Tim Keller wrote a book. Let me read a little bit from The Prodigal God. It says, "Nearly everyone defines sin as breaking the list of rules. Jesus, though, shows us that a man who has violated virtually nothing on the list of moral misbehaviors can be every bit as spiritually lost as the most prolific immoral person. Why? Because sin is not just breaking the rules. It's putting yourself in the place of God as Savior, Lord, and Judge. Pride in his good deeds, rather than remorse over his bad deeds, was keeping the older son out of the feast of salvation. The elder brother's problem is his self-righteousness, the way he uses his moral record to put God and others in his debt to control them and get them to do what he wants. His spiritual problem is the radical insecurity that comes from basing his self-image on achievements and performance. So he must endlessly prop up his sense of righteousness by putting others down and finding fault. As one of my teachers in seminary put it, the main barrier between the Pharisees and God is not their sins, but their damnable good works. So what happens? Father responds. It's a gracious response. He says, "My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." That's the end of the parable. Jesus drops the parable and walks off the stage, right? That's it. Remember the context. Remember the tension. You could cut with a knife. The Pharisees are sitting there. He knows darn well that he's talking about them. And that they're better than those sinners and tax collectors. And how dare anyone who thinks that they're talking on behalf of God favor them and not these righteous people. So the question is, and it's not listed here, what happened? Again, these people don't exist. Jesus made them up in their mind. But what? Let's use our own little imagination here. What happened in this story moving forward? To look at it this way, the Pharisees were the older brother, right? They've done all this other stuff. Sure. They still needed salvation. They're still sinners. In the Bible, there are Pharisees. There's a couple different kinds, right? There's a few of them who Nicodemus would be one of them. If you read the end of, I think it's the Gospel of Luke, where it talks about Joseph of Arimathea, who he was also a Pharisee. On Jesus' death, he went in and he asked for the body of Jesus, and he put it in his own tomb. Can you imagine what that conversation was with his wife? hey, I want to get the body of Jesus, I want to put it in our tomb. She says, what? Like, what? What, are you crazy? He says, it's just for the weekend. Bad joke. You see Pharisees, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, these guys get it. And they say, if they were to continue the parable, they would say, oh my gosh, Dad, I'm just like him. I'm just like him, except I've done it in a very different way. I didn't go wild and all that. I tried to gain your affection, and you think you owed me because I'm like, I need to be forgiven too. Can I come into the party? And the father would say, all that is yours. Come on, let's go. Or, like many Pharisees, did they reject him? And if you put that down where it keeps going in the story, what the Pharisees did, it would go into the parable that the older brother looks at his father, reaches down and grabs a stone and beats the old man to death. Because that's what they did. That's the parable of the lost sons, the parable of the prodigal son. You get an opportunity here at Antioch to have a reboot in sharing that wonderful message with not only ourselves, but with everybody else. Invite the worship team back up. Do you do that? Because I know you've got a song, so I'm assuming it's okay. But we don't have anything yet. Come on up. And I'd love for you to use this last song as a way to reflect on this. A way to reflect about what does this mean for you as an individual? What does this mean for you as a community, as you guys move forward? Let me just give you a couple songs to think about. Just give you a couple of questions to think about while you're singing this last song. First off, will you come home? For maybe somebody in the room, they've never had the opportunity to come home to Jesus. And today can be the day you say yes to Jesus. I lay down all my acts that have been opposed to you, that have come across as negative, and I lay down all the things that I've done that I think that you owe me. You owe me nothing. And yet, I know if I just come to you, even impurely, as best I can, like the prodigal son did, you'll come running to get me. Come home. Some of us maybe have wandered a little bit, either as the younger brother or as the older brother. Wandered into that. I want to invite everybody here this morning to come home. Secondly, I want to be, it's your church. The aim of this church is to help as many people as possible come home. Will we re-challenge ourselves to be that kind of community where we can help people come home, come to Jesus? And then lastly, do you resemble the prodigal God in the way he reaches out? Let's pray together. Father, I was blown away by this parable. I love getting a chance to share it, and I love your amazing heart. God, there's folks in this room right now to absolutely know, no matter what's gone on in their life, that as you see them as a dot in the distance, that you come running out to them, that you grab them, you squeeze them, and you kiss them, and you deeply desire that. It blows our mind. It maybe blows our picture of who you are, because you're also holy and just. But all of that you took upon yourself, Christ, when you ran or when you went to the cross and humbled yourself, shamed yourself, let the sin, our sin, go on your shoulders. God, it's no small thing. So I just pray for every single person here, wherever they're at, that they'd come home. Lord, I pray too that they'd be eager to see more and more folks come home to you. We do that in such a way that gives you glory and us joy. We pray this all in Jesus' name.